everyone in the world of cyberspace. You are listening and or watching to the Carnival of Bastards. Yes, we're a couple of Doctor Who fans who love it so much that we can't help but bag the crap out of it. My name is David Innes, and with me is St. John Karp. Hello, St. John.
Hello, David Innes.
We're starting with looking through our childhood.
Our
collective childhood, yes. Starting with something that we both really enjoyed, something both of our memory, and also my very first Doctor Who story.
Was this your first?
This was my first. The Five Doctors was the first thing I ever saw when I was 10 years old. And
I reckon our first review is The Five Doctors, and then when we get into the swing of it later, we can do a Five Doctors special edition review.
That's exactly right, where we take the current boring effects of us now. And
someone once told me that the Five Doctors special edition just replaced crappy 80s effects with crappy 90s effects.
That's exactly how it worked.
That's exactly how it works. I mean, liked the black triangles.
Yeah, well, see, what they did is just they seem to have gone, again, much to represent fans' wankdom, they replaced the black triangles with some sort of ethereal ejaculation that goes on and smothers people and takes them away.
I wanted to know who thought some water tornado was scarier than a black prism. Black prism, great. Water tornado looks like someone flushing a toilet.
Well, I suppose that's why it's called that. I imagine someone who, again, needed to excessively masturbate but was feeling guilty about it.
What do you mean it's called that? Do you call your toilet a water tornado?
That's exactly what I do. Excuse me, Lord Albemarle, I need to go to the water tornado for just a moment. So, the opening speech, you know, that same speech that's memorized by lots of fans for generations to come, to quote, at awkward dinner parties, yes, it is the one day I shall come back. The one thing I noticed when re-watching this William Hartnell reminder is that really it's just a statement that means sod all. It has nothing to do with the story. It doesn't help at all.
Oh, hang on. It's called The Five Doctors. They had to somehow shoehorn William Hartnell into it, and that's as good a moment as any. And it's when he tells Susan that he's going to come back, and then he does see Susan again. Not that he intended it.
Oh,
but...
well, I suppose the theory, but what makes that a better line than, you know, maybe sort of the Time Meddler? What do you think this is, eh? A space helmet for a cow?
If you'd had your shoes on you, you could have lent her hers.
See? All works with the crashing theme music in there.
What would have been better?
Well, I don't know, the various fluffs from the Gunfighters, maybe.
Hang on, how about just the entire Gunfighters? How about that? just the song.
So, yes, the people have to go to the Ballad of the Last Chancellor. The one thing I also noticed, speaking of the title sequence, is they actually got rid of that stupid bloody vacuum sound effect they do when the actual titles come in. Because for some reason, Peter Howell thought, I need to fade out the sound. So instead of just fading out the theme, he put this... And I was so glad to get rid of that. Unless, just for that particular special recording, they didn't have the cleaner in the background.
Are you going to give your impressions of all of the incidental music in this story? Because this is a pretty good story for incidental music.
Oh, the thing that freaked me out the most, remember, this was the first thing I'd ever watched. So, well, not the first literal thing, first Doctor Who thing.
The Horn of Rassilon.
Wasn't the Horn of Rassilon that freaked me out? It was the music that accompanies the Black Triangle, the Time Scoop. Dun, dun, dun.
Oh! Dun, dun, dun. I thought the horn... No, the horn is when they're actually in the death zone, and they look at the tower, and there's that... That was more of a Peter Griffin whine, I feel, rather than the horn of ancient wrestling.
The Peter Griffin of wrestling. Yeah. Oh, Lowish. The game of Rashilon's not a food. It was that incidental music that accompanied the Black Triangle that freaked me out. And I used to have nightmares about that music. It wasn't the Dalek or anything, it was that bloody
music. Well, the Dalek doesn't do particularly much except shoot itself. That's probably the stupid Dalek from the chase.
Bugger.
What are we going to do with Jeff? He's a bit slow. Oh, I know. Let's put him in an enclosed space with an energy weapon.
In the history of Daleks, in Power of the Daleks, are clever enough to pretend that they're subservient to humans, enough to take over a colony. They know how to travel through time. They've gone and enslaved the entire planets. Yet here we go. They get blown up for being in a carnival hall of mirrors. I mean, for God's sakes, what's happened to them?
They also can't chase a geriatric old man, I notice. You know, they can fly. They can zip across rooms. I mean, I assume they can work up a fair speed, you know, on a straight piece of road.
Yes, well,
with no turns or pebbles. But they can't chase this old man down a corridor.
No, that's really kind of, especially when they're not really running so much as they're drunkenly swaying side to side down.
Well, I assume the set was about 5 meters big, and they had to run continually across it.
Pretty much, that's exactly.
Running involves jogging on the spot, although Caroline Ford has a lot of experience with that, we know.
And yet this Dalek is stupid. In fact, actually, the thing watching it on DVD is that everything's so much clearer, and one of the issues is that Dalek looks like it's in a pretty crap shape.
Really? I didn't notice.
If you look at the head, it's got this large chip in it, which made me realize, you know, it's that great sort of production thing. Here's a Dalek. Dear. Oh, I'll just give it a dust down and wheel it out.
Maybe it saw its reflection in one of the mirrors and sort of ran into itself like a parrot running into a mirror.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if this is Jeff the Stupid Dalek. I really love that's its name now. I every time I'm going to refer Jeff the Dalek, it's definitely the one that goes, and definitely gets shot in the Five Doctors. I'd also like to think that Jeff, or at least a relative of Jeff, was that Dalek in Death of the Daleks that goes overly panicky when it loses the prisoners.
Which one gets overly panicky? Oh, that's right, the one that commits suicide when it loses the prisoners.
Yes, that one. I have found.
Five Doctors. That's the story we're talking about, isn't it?
Pretty much. I was noticing also with the great new console with the...
Oh, it looks great.
It is. It looks fantastic. And even when I saw it at the Doctor Who Experience, when I went to London this year, still looks fantastic. It also makes more bloopy noises.
Yeah, I always love the effect when the time rotor comes to a stop and the lights turn off and it makes that wonderful clonk noise. Yeah. Well, I was going to say clonk, but gloom is a bit more elegant, I feel.
Well, clonk, it is definitely a clonk. I would describe it in that...
I feel there's some clonk in there.
It was brought back and used in the TARDIS for the Time of the Angels. When Riversong is controlling the TARDIS, the clonk is heard again.
I didn't know that. So, what, the clonk came back just once when Riversong flies the TARDIS? It's because, what, because she's flying it properly?
Yes. When she's flying it properly, the clonk sound is heard. Also,
I noticed she can fly it properly, but Romana can't.
Well, remember that Riversong is basically the TARDIS's daughter. So, you know, the TARDIS is in her brain, so yes, whereas Romana is just, you know, a uni graduate. I mean, think about the uni graduates, do you know? Do you think that they could possibly go and do anything that's remotely useful? In fact, I think Romana 1 is a great example of uni students. You know, all they do is swan about wanting to get laid, wearing...
You know, somehow I can't picture her camping out at cafes, smoking clove cigarettes and talking about Marxism.
No, she was definitely not one of those. She was definitely one of the, you know, the preppy style. She was wearing all the latest fashions and talking about, oh, my daddy bought me this degree.
She's,
you know,
not
that
dumb.
Sort of
She's not a valley girl or anything.
No, not valley girl. Like that pompous sort of, you know, it's like, oh my God, totally, those people were, you know...
You're describing valley girl again.
Your face is a valley girl, you know?
It's taken us 11 minutes only to get to a your face joke. I can see we're maintaining the quality of this.
And we've got as far as the opening sequence.
Oh God, yes.
We've got this far. I'm still adamant that Romana 1 was a snobby university girl who possibly bullied the other time ladies and, you know, took them to sorority parties.
Oh, yeah, Romana's quite nasty. I believe she could bully. I'll go for that.
Yes, I bet there was a lot of kissing in the, you know, the time closet between the young eligible Time Lords and the Time Ladies.
Do Time Lords kiss? I can't imagine Flavia ever kissing behind the watershed or
That's
anything.
That's because she's old. And when they're young and sprightly...
Yeah, before they hit their 99th birthday.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much.
Just try and pry them apart.
They're going to party like they're 1999 years old. We get to the Eye of Orion. That's probably the next part.
Yes. And this is probably... Oh, God, we're not going to talk about whales, are
no.
we?
No. I don't give a crap that it's whales. What I do give a crap about is the fact that this is probably one of the only times Turlough's not looking shifty.
That's because he has nothing to do in this story at all.
Well, he generally doesn't have much to do.
He stands around in the TARDIS going, ho-ho-ho-ho, looks big, doesn't it?
Yes, he turns into a carry-on character throughout. Although, arguably, I suppose he could be drawing something shifty.
It's a bit of a letdown for something that's been hyped so much and keeps getting talked about as the most peaceful place in the universe. It seems to be just a field with a tree in the middle.
Fields with trees and are pretty peaceful. I accept it.
No, they're not. Places with armchairs and big exotic drinks are peaceful.
So you're saying the Eye of Orion...
grass and rocks and trees are not.
Are you saying that the Eye of Orion needs more margaritas the size of your head?
Oh, the head margarita.
Yes, they've clearly mixed up the Eye of Orion whales with the Eye of Orion excellent bar.
The Eye of Orion Club Med.
Yeah. Yes, they've clearly mixed up the two, and there's really an actual Eye of Orion that, you know, is full of armchairs and margaritas the size of your head.
Let's jump ahead a little bit. If we keep going at this pace, we are going to be old and grey. I was thinking about the Castellan, actually, because
now, yes.
He is famous for misdelivering every single line he has, such as, "He has arrived, and I have never seen that casket before."
Yeah, he has an emphasis problem. But to
our all-time favourites, no, not the mind
probe.
As if the mind burrito would have been just fine, but the mind probe is just out of the question.
And the burrito of wrestling.
A power-boosted, open-ended transmat beam.
Well, I know why that happens. The reason why is because most of those actors have no idea what they're saying. And actually, funnily enough, if you look at that whole show... all Time Lords seem to have a horrible speech impediment, because not only have you got the Castellan being his, I'm talking like some kind of robot, you've also got Brusa, who, I don't know if you could actually understand him, but...
You can't.
Well, that's nonsense. He's always sounded perfectly fine. That's just
no,
you.
No, that is not me. This version of Brusa... he drops the end of every word, and...
You preferred Deadly Assassin, High Camp, Lisping Brusa.
Well, yes, because at least I could understand what he was saying.
Actually, he's always my favourite Brusa, to be honest.
Because he's Ponzi, you know. Was it?
Yes.
9 out of 10, Doctor? Was that the phrase? But now it's got, you know, it's like, Commander! You remember the man term! What the... What? What?
I need someone cutting... Hey, me! This person doesn't please me.
That's a lot of cock. He's absolutely fine.
He's not fine.
What about Flavia? She doesn't screw anything up, does she?
No, she's just pointless.
Yes, she is. Pointless she's and there female.
She's basically there to be the dolly bird.
She's the best the BBC could come up with to pretty the place up a bit. I've got a question about the Castellan, actually, because he was in Ark of Infinity as well, which I don't remember well. Does he cock up his lines in that story as well?
I would hope so. I haven't watched the Ark of Infinity in years, but I can only hope
so. When we get round to that, we need to see if he delivers his lines the same way.
But actually, speaking of that sort of whole terrible things, the guard, you know, as you can see, he was armed.
He was trying to escape.
Even the little technician has a shh in his voice.
He's not Fred Flintstone.
he was trying to escape.
No, that's Yogi Bear. He was trying to escape.
He was trying to escape with his picnic basket. listen to it, watch it again. Brusa is impossible to understand.
Even when he has the coronet of Rassilon and starts shouting
people. Yeah, well, in that means... Oh, no, he just goes from mumbly to Louis Armstrong, because it's basically, I have the coronet of Rassilon! So, you know.
Hilarious as that is, he doesn't do that at all.
He does! He really does. You'd have to watch it again. And it's great, because Anthony Ainley and Leonard Sachs having that vocal disability off, you know, I love the fact that, I don't know if the writer, Terrence Dicks, subliminally put this in, but I hope that they just gave Anthony Ainley as many S words as possible, so he could, the universe without the Doctor scarcely bears thinking of a sh- You know, I think he's possibly a kettle.
I read just last night that John Pertwee was somebody's godfather. He knew the Ainleys. He knew Anthony Ainley's father.
Yes, and they hated each other.
What do you mean they hated each other? I didn't know that.
Because John Pertwee, as we... for those who aren't familiar, John Pertwee used to have a habit of giving notes to people. And Anthony Ainley was one of these people he gave notes to and suggestions of how to improve their performance. And he vehemently disliked it, said, sensible that he said, I only accept notes from the director. And they hate each other. And then John Pertwee kept slagging him off at convention, saying he was a poor imitation and he was offensive to the memory of Roger Delgado. And I can understand that Anthony Ainley thinks he's a complete load of pompous ass.
I can see that. Although it is true that Anthony Ainley was not a patch on Delgado, it seems unfair to blame him for that.
I think if Anthony Ainley was given his own, let himself be a new version of the Master, would be happy, but...
You think he was either miscast or miswritten?
He was misdirected. Frequently, he was often told, especially by JNT, to ham it up.
Huh, okay.
Rather than an actual villain. Like, in Logopolis, is probably...
He was villainous in Survival, I thought. He genuinely had a dark side.
Yes, sorry, I will take that. In Survival, he was let do his own thing. He wasn't told to ham it up, so that's why he got rid of the penguin outfit, which was, thank God.
I never thought of it as a penguin outfit, more as some kind of freaky velvet fetish suit.
Okay, so it was a freaky velvet fetish suit. Whatever's easier to say.
Well, speaking of the Master, they offer him in this story a new set of regenerations. Are we going to talk about that?
Well, that's what's there to say, apart from sounds like a Terrence Dicks going, I wonder how I would get the Master to cooperate. Oh, there we go.
Well, yeah, but continuity-wise, what is the impact of Time Lords actually being able to regenerate more than 12 times?
Well, he is like basically a Time Lord inhabiting a Trakan body. I imagine what they're doing, they've probably got some Derek down in, mailroom who has not read his contract properly. And basically what would happen is that, Derek, I need you to come to my office, club, and, absorb his body out and shove the Master in there.
And they're not seriously expecting the Master to sort the mail, are
they? No. You'd go back to what he's doing. They'd have to employ a new guy, I imagine.
So basically, they're going to give the Master a new set of regenerations and let him loose and say, off you go. Job well done, mate. We like what... We're a big fan of your work. I love what you've done with the place. Now, on your way,
pretty
son.
Pretty much. And that's where you get the... and so Derek the mailroom boy... Unfortunately,
becomes the new Master.
Yes, that's how it works. Although, to be fair, the Time Lords never really keep promises, and they're all basically squabbling politicians anyway. So
they might not have kept the promise, but the Master seems to think it's possible. And they actually make this possible in Lungbarrow, the book, where the Doctor actually goes home, and they have these genetic looms on which Time Lords are born. And it is possible to have yourself, rewoven from scratch, but you're not supposed to do it.
Well, which you have to admit, the whole concept of these looms are pretty much because fans don't want the idea of the Doctor bonking. That's all it is.
That's true. The Time Lords seem pretty asexual. I've never seen Time Lords hitting anyone, except maybe Andred and Leela. But I think it is interesting, though. It has an interesting bearing on the Five Doctors, because in Lungbarrow, we find out that there was a triumvirate at the dawn of Time Lord society. There was Rassilon, Omega, and the Other. And we don't know who this Other is. He's mysterious even to Rassilon. And the Other has himself, rewoven in the looms. And out pops the Doctor out of nowhere. So, by explaining the Doctor's origins, they needed
to... you couldn't just...
make it more mysterious. They couldn't have explained the Doctor's origins, solve everything. So they've opened it up and made it more mysterious.
You couldn't just have the Doctor. It was just a Time Lord who got pissed off. They had to make him into some kind of demigod. For God's sake.
But in this story, he meets Rassilon, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
And Rassilon sees him, and they don't seem to recognize each other. It's not, You again? What are you doing here? We're just throwing out all continuity.
That's
here,
exactly,
are we?
I mean, for God's sakes, this is the story that completely and utterly created that stupid season 6B theory. With the doctor saying that Jamie and Zoe were sent home at the war games, implying that he escaped his regeneration somehow.
No, I'm just wondering, where does this doctor come from? Where does this second doctor come from?
Well, the theory lies that...
Because he has no companions. No. He's just sort of visiting the brig.
Yeah, well, the theory goes that he... Well, when he was sent on trial in the war games, that actually it was a show trial. And that he was actually in the process of, that's why he gets sent on doing missions, as shown in The Two Doctors. And then he's trying to actually just escape from his eventual regeneration. So this is him, when that line, steer the TARDIS, is basically him trying to break away from the Time Lord control, in order to escape from...
What's happened to Jamie at this point, then?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know.
Your little theory didn't cover that, did it?
No. Well, this is not my...
See, I ask you about looms, and you've got nothing for me. But get you started on 6B, and I can't shut you up.
No, well, clearly I have, because I've got nothing more for 6B, have I? I don't know. It was just a stupid line, two stupid sets of lines of dialogue that completely screwed up Doctor Who continuity.
Forever and ever and ever, and I've never been able to watch the show since. I cry myself to sleep at night next to my five doctors prayer wheel.
I thought you were going to say a speak and say. So it's like, the first doctor says, the original, I might say. The second doctor says,
you've redecorated, haven't you?
Yeah. At this point, if watching the five doctors, even within the first 5 minutes, it already pones the three doctors.
That's true. Well, the Three Doctors was crap from start to finish.
It was, because Dix writes the Doctors as just the same character, but relying the actors to put their own spin on it, which is different to Baker and Martin, who basically do an idiot's guide to Doctor stereotypes, and they're practically almost going to get Patrick Tout to go, oh, hello, Miss Grant, I'm the space hobo, you know. That's close...
That's a Dix line, isn't it?
I'm the space hobo.
Yeah, Terrence Dix goes around saying that at conventions and when receiving his OBE, I'm a space hobo. No,
I thought it was a Bonzo Dog Doodah song.
I'm the urban space hobo.
Because I've already commanded you to re-watch this program, because I want you to re-watch it simply for...
I only just watched it for this.
Rewatch it for Brucer, but I would love...
Oh, for fuck's sake, as if I haven't seen it often enough.
But it's a great story to watch it, but I would...
I'm sorry it wasn't my very first Doctor Who ever.
I
apologise.
Just listen, you ask. Rewatch it for... And just every time John Pertwee is on screen, imagine that his internal mantra is, I'm the best. I'm the best. I'm the best.
Oh, no, he's always come across... He's always come across that way. There was never any doubt that his ego is about three times the size of his body.
Well, that's... I mean, what's what do you get with that thing? And everything's like, yes, well, I'll just go and swagger up with this line. Yes, I'll just... Go, da, 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 da. He definitely has that mantra.
Poor Peter Davison in that mix, you know, standing next to Patrick Troughton and John Pertwee. He must have been like a kicked puppy. He's far too nice to... assert himself.
Oh, absolutely. Like, funny enough, Patrick Troughton does an excellent job just being an actor rather than being ego, whereas John Pertwee is playing entirely ego.
That's true. What about Richard Herndahl? Was he easy to work with?
Well, from what I understand, he was alright. In fact, there's no gossip about him, so I can only assume he was alright.
He kicked it immediately after filming this story,
didn't he?
Before it went to air.
A lot of fans have a bitch about, you know, oh, he looks nothing like the first Doctor. Shut up! Would you rather this or, like, Dimensions in Time, pickles in a jar? That's, you know, or gherkins in a jar. No.
Gherkins, thank
sorry,
you.
Sorry, gurkles? Oh, God. Gherkins in a jar.
Pockled like gherkles in a jar.
But
there's some classic Dix dialogue there.
Yes. But Herndahl does an excellent job, and I won't hear anything else.
He does a very good job, except when he's molesting that pineapple.
You know, in the VHS, that...
What is that about?
The pineapple scene is not in the VHS.
Well, is this the VHS that inserted episode breaks?
No, I'm talking about the original 90 Days VHS. This is what I watched
Oh, la-dee-da.
I'm pretty sure I do not remember him molesting Pineapple. And
he molests the Pineapple at least once, but there's an outtake of him doing it worse, where he manages to have this orgasmic, like, plants his face in the middle of the Pineapple, wham, and starts, you know,
kind of sort of
jumping and munching and gobbling, and he has it all over his face. It's completely disgusting.
He's got a sort of rat face when he does it, you know. It's just that sort of...
Well, so does the first Doctor, to be fair.
When he does, he eats the pineapple. But yeah, he certainly... There was no pineapple-age in the original VHS. I will have...
Why would they cut that out for time? It wasn't running over, was it?
I think people said that a lot of shit thing to have. This pineapple scene.
What was the direction? Here's some fruit. Eat it menacingly, will you? I mean, we're walking into danger. Just have a menacing bit of pineapple and we'll get on with it.
Like, they're in the middle of some panic, yet they have enough time to bring out some wicker chairs and a bowl of fruit.
Yeah, see, no, they decided the Eye of Orion was so fucking boring they needed a goddamn margarita the size of your head. That's why...
They went to the
that's
proper...
That's where they came
they
from.
They went to the proper Eye of Orion. That was the thing.
Yeah, they stopped off on the way when the Doctor was having one of his moments. Yeah. Quick, he's out. Let's go.
Herndl has that wonderful line that is more hilarious each time I watch it, which is the, I might be a number of things, young lady. Well, what could you be? Clown? CEO of a bank? A small convict colony in the Maldives?
I was like, what are you young people doing in my TARDIS?
Yes.
As if no one has ever been in his TARDIS before.
No. But I like the fact that it had to emphasize that I'm old, so therefore you're young people. And actually, speaking of that,
yeah.
You know that bit when they're with all the wicker chairs and they're having their margaritas?
Yeah.
And Turlough has that...
Are those the White Guardian's wicker chairs?
Yeah, probably. He probably pinched it when he got it back. You know, there's a bit where Turlough says something along the lines of, how do you know we are in the Death Zone? And Peter Davison goes... Because of the Tower of Rassilon! And it's as if to say, how dare you not know about our ancient forbidden knowledge, you ass!
Well, the second Doctor gets a better time of it, I feel. He delivers that line better and has a better repartee with the Brigadier.
But to be fair, they are the best couple in the entire show. Like, a lot of people say that Sarah Jane Smith is very good. No, I think that there's nothing finer than Nicholas Courtney... With his zingers.
Are you in pain, Doctor?
They're such a great duo, and Patrick Chan is as I was watching...
That's true, actually. You are absolutely right. Sarah Jane does a good job, but this isn't her finest story.
No. And I found it very hard to comment on Patrick Chan and Nicholas Courtney, because it was nothing... It was just such a joy to watch them on screen.
You weren't more excited... by the fight with the Rastan Warrior robot?
With the Rastan Warrior with his incredibly pert ass.
Well, I know where your eyes were.
Well, I'm sorry, but when you've got cheeks covering up the screen, it's really hard to ignore.
They're not covering up the screen. Actually, you know why they're covering up the screen? JNT directed that scene.
I mean, for God's sakes, he's bending over. He's basically saying, come on, boys, I'm ready for your close-up.
I'm sorry, is this your dubbed version? Is this the Mystery Science Theatre 3000 David Innes style?
Isn't that what this is? That's what it looks like. And basically, if you were to be Philip Sandifer, I'm sure it's subtext.
Oh, well, Philip Sandifer would say... But they're subtly making fun of the show. Actually, I used to make fun of the Rastan Warrior robot for not killing the Doctor and Sarah, even when they are jumping all over the screen. Yet the second the Cybermen turn up, he goes on a killing spree. I think he can see the Doctor and Sarah. I think the Rastan Warrior robot knows they're there and is toying with them, because he deliberately misses and then sort of jumps behind them and next to them rather than actually killing them straight away. It's only when the entire platoon of Cybermen turn up that he gets serious and seems to want to kill everyone.
Or he could take the Russell T. Davies approach and clearly... The Rastan Warrior robot knows something that Sarah Jane has to go on to become a, you know, defender of the Earth, and he won't want to mess up the timelines.
Oh, fuck's sake. don't start putting prophecies into this. If you start putting some Russell T. Davies prophecies into the Five Doctors, I swear to God, every 5 seconds, he tells you what's about to happen, and then it happens, and then everyone acts surprised.
Even with that, he's still... more brilliant than anything else. I'm always a big fan of Russell T.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, no, I won't criticize his genius. Just say that it is imperfect.
My question is, in this story, how the hell did the Doctor and the Master not notice the Cybermen when they were, like, 3 feet away?
I want to know how the Cybermen didn't notice the Doctor and the Master when they were 3 feet away. Because they're looking right at each other. Oh, no, I'm thinking of the scene inside the tower, yes, right before the chessboard.
Yes, where the first Doctor and Susan run off. Yes, there is that moment. Because the Cybermen do notice the fifth Doctor and Master because it has that wonderful line.
Ah.
Ah. Which is eliminated in the special edition.
Oh, what a load of cock.
Notice, I mean, they're clomping around. You've got the Peter Howell clomping music. Surely something gives them away.
I love how badly the Master lies as well when the Doctor vanishes and the Master is stuck with the Cybermen, and the Master basically goes, I'm on your side. Mm. And the Cybermen go, oh yeah, that sounds logical to me.
Yeah, it's true. He is here, and we're here.
Yeah.
He must be with us. Yeah.
Yeah, why is he here? He must be on our side.
You know Jeff the Dalek?
Yeah.
Clearly has a relative, Gerald the Cyberman. They clearly weren't the brightest. They... But getting towards the end, there are a few things that I either make me angry or I laugh at. And one of them is our favourite, the generic product of Rassilon. And I think this is probably one of the stories that have the most ridiculous things of Rassilon. Like, before the story, it was all like...
What is it, the riddle of Rassilon?
Well, it was the game of Rassilon, the harp of Rassilon.
The horn of Rassilon.
The horn of Rassilon. See, before that, it was just all, rods and sashes. Now, you got to get the burger bar of Rassilon.
Oh, the coronet of Rassilon? You're right. This story does have an odd preponderance of Rassilon's crap. They must have just been looting Rassilon's room, basically. Well, apparently everything he owned was completely magical. His keys could, open black holes. His hat can control minds. His harp opens up secret passages. Yes. Basically, everything he had was magic. Yes. Oh, his scarf can protect you from a black hole.
I just have this image of, jock university timelords going, hey, baby, I'm wearing the underpants of Rassilon.
I wonder what that opens up. The cup of tea of Rassilon can explode suns.
Yes.
The armpit hair of Rassilon. Phoenix tears of Rassilon. Next thing you're going to be telling me they've got healing powers.
Yes. The tears of baby Rassilon.
Sorry, baby Rassilon had to have had the gigantic fruity mustache as well.
Of course. And that ridiculous hat.
He was born that way.
Did someone need to change his nappies? I know, it will be freed. I imagine a baby with that Rassilon voice. I know. So, mommy, would you like to play the game of Rassilon as well? Do you seek immortality too?
Be sure. Be very sure. I've decided you could have some ice cream. You have chosen wisely. Narrative-wise, that final scene is actually quite interesting because the Doctor does fuck all. He fails to stop the bad guy, and it's basically the bad guy walking into a trap set by somebody else that wraps the story up. The Doctor doesn't save the day. The only decision the Doctor makes at the end is not to walk into the same, now very, very obvious trap that Berusa did. So what is the Doctor for in this story? Does he actually do anything?
Well, he has to get to that point, so he has to break the force field. He needs to go through.
Well, yeah, but that's not really a satisfying thing from a character point of view. That's a very cynical plot device. No one's paying attention is why he gets away with it.
If it wasn't for the first Doctor, who's the youngest, yes, most wise, if it was for him, they would all say, no, you can't have your immortality. And then, who knows what would have happened. All I know is that it was fine. I didn't question it. It was great.
Well, the first Doctor is the most wise, apparently. He's the one who says that Berusa should have it.
Yeah, exactly, but he's the youngest of all the Doctors.
Oh, that's right. I thought you were talking about Peter Davison.
No. I was talking about the youngest physically, maybe, but not actually in chronologically.
Yeah, yeah. No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
But I don't question this. What I do question, based on my knowledge from the very first episode of Doctor Who, for Man Unearthly Child, the TARDIS is indestructible. So why the hell are they worried that some bombs are going to blow it up?
Oh, Tolu's retarded. We know that. It's Susan who should have known better.
I know. So what was that all about?
Beats the hell out of me. I mean, it's fallen over cliffs and into, you know, flown into suns and things before, hasn't it?
Or was it exactly. Or was it simply that so Tolu could have that horribly horrible line? Big, isn't it?
It's because they had nothing else for him to do. They needed some threat to be encroaching on the TARDIS. And there is no threat that can encroach on the TARDIS, so they had to pull something from out of their ass.
What's interesting is that last scene when the Fifth Doctor finds Barusa is a few things. How would you feel if you walked into a room and you found a cackling man with all of you and your friends on, you know, on the table? That'd be kind of weird.
I think I was at Folsom Street Fair or something.
Well, it's...
I think I'd wandered into Mr. S.
Well, yeah, but it's really weird. It would just be thrown, it's like, oh my god, you've got me and my best friends and bits of my...
You would just think he's nuts, wouldn't you?
Well, he does, because it's like, the Barusa wants the Doctor to succeed, yet he purposely puts enemies in there just to fight him.
He needed a distraction. I'll buy into that. I mean, it is a cynical plot point, but I think it works because the Doctor needed someone to pin it on.
Yeah.
To think it's you who's doing this.
Yes.
And to draw suspicion away from Barusa, he needed, like, the Master and some Cybermen just to spice it up a bit.
But what doesn't make sense is that line where he talks about the reason why he wants immortality, and he says, my work half done. Work half done? What the hell does a Lord President do, apart from be completely impotent to the Time Lord rules, as in Three Doctors, to be assassinated in The Deadly Assassin, to provide wanky advice in The Invasion of Time, not even prevent Centaurans and Vardans, tinfoils in space, from invading, and then goes about and does pointless in the Ark of Infinity. What work has he done?
Oh, Barusa does fuck all.
But... So what work has he done that he's only halfway through it? Has he only just managed to play the half of Rassilon? Or maybe he's only just got his butt groove in the chair of Rassilon?
The butt groove of Rassilon. I imagine that's something that you mould your butt to rather than something that moulds to your butt.
Well, you'd hope so. Otherwise, that'd be kind of weird.
What? So your butt looks exactly like Rassilon's by the end of your tenure as president?
That's including moustache. But I have to say, speaking of Rassilon, the face looks great.
It does. I like the colour lights and everything. I think it works well.
It looks great, and that's why I was so appalled by the special edition, which warps his voice and face. Like, what are you doing? It looks great as it is.
They needed to do something to earn their, you know, $5. We've given you a truckload of money to do this special edition, so what'd you do apart from Casper the Friendly Ghost? Rassilon, we did some things to Rassilon.
We wobbled him.
Yeah, good enough.
That bit where, of course, Barusa turns into the statue of himself, it's a great little bit of scene.
Oh my god, that looks good. I had such a simple special effect, but it looks great. It took me a long time to figure out how they did
that. Well, it looks really, really awesome. And again, that music that goes with it sells it. See,
it does.
It could look like ridiculous people wobbling their eyes about, but you've got that wonderful organ music. And it is a fantastic bit, which is wonderful. I remember when I first watched it, and to me it looked nothing like Barusa, because they used the same sort of vacuum seal mask, but, it's a chilling moment, and it's wonderful.
Well, I think it's a class act as a story, and despite its many, many faults that we have turned over today.
It's brilliant. It is all sorts of brilliant. As I say, I'm happy to take the piss out of it, but it's stuck. It's what got me into the sad Doctor Who fan I am today. And
part of both of our childhoods.
Well, exactly. And Terrence Dix this is an amazing story.
Uncle Terry.
And I don't know. Should we put a rating system? I don't know if there's a.
Oh, no! I don't want to do a rating system.
I was about to say I don't particularly care, but all I can say is, I love it, and I hope that we may have uncovered things people haven't thought of, and they probably haven't thought of it because there's a good reason. So, but
yeah,
I hope that
someone will want to hear about it. Trust me.
I only hope.
Well, any thoughts on the next story, then?
Well, I was thinking, we were talking about, this was the story I first watched, and I thought, well, why not we see the story that you first watched, which of course was
That's a really good idea.
Death to the Daleks, was it not?
And it's about to come out, I believe.
On DVD. And you know my opinion of that story, and I know yours. So I think that our next dear listener would be Death to the Daleks. In any case, we hope that you've enjoyed listening to The Carnival of Bastards.
I've been St. John Carr.
And I've been David Innes. And have a wonderful day, and you too shall be freed.
You have chosen wisely.